Relevance Seminar. My name is Jean Balance, and I'll be serving as your online moderator for our session today. I'm part of the EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, and I welcome those of you, the nearly three and a half dozen individuals from all over the country who are joining us for today's seminar. Today's seminar is part of the NARPM Presents series, which is being hosted throughout this year on the CLUIN website. And our seminar today is going to cover practical applications and methods of optimization across the Superfund pipeline. This is part two of a seminar series that's being covering that particular topic. So we've already delivered part one previously this month, and you can find a recorded version of that seminar already available on the CLUIN website. Let's go ahead and cover some reminder information on how we're actually going to host and have people join us for today's broadcast. When you registered for today's seminar, you would have received a confirmation email as well as a reminder email with instructions on how to join us for our session. That email would have directed you to something called the seminar homepage. On the seminar homepage, you could find a complete description of the session, contact information for the presenters, links to download the materials in a few different formats. But most importantly, there's a button in the upper left corner that says Go to Seminar. If you were to click that button, you'll be able to identify yourself and then actually check in and join us for the online broadcast. Our presenters will be controlling what you see using this new tool. If you participated in part one, we used our traditional or classic seminar approach where each attendee got to turn the page at verbal cues from our presenters. With this new tool, Adobe Connect, our presenters will control what you see. So if you'd like to be able to take notes on the materials, I'd refer you back to the seminar homepage to download an electronic copy to have at your reference during our session today. As I said, we're going to broadcast this entire session through Adobe Connect. By default, all of our participants will be able to watch this broadcast in real time and listen to the audio online. If you have problems with the Adobe Connect environment, you can certainly download a copy of the materials and simply follow along by the telephone. But we do encourage you to try to join us online for that full interactive experience. If you're having any difficulties with the online audio option, the first thing I'm going to ask is that you check your local volume settings. You may simply need to turn the volume up on your speakers or actually go into the sound control panel on your computer and increase your speaker output. Sometimes simply wearing a pair of headphones can drastically help increase the audio. If the audio is skipping, you still can't increase the volume, we do have toll-free call-in information. We'll be happy to share with anyone who needs it. Just type a message into the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen, and I'll share that call-in number with those who need it. Please know, though, if you're joining us on the telephone lines, we will globally mute everyone. We ask that you remain on that global mute to help cut down on background noises or other disruptions. We have a series of windows that are open on the screen in front of you today. I'm going to point you to something in the lower right corner in just a moment called the Q&A window. There's already a welcome message from me in there, and that's going to be the sole way you'll be able to submit your questions and comments and report technical problems during the broadcast today. If you'd like to type in a comment or question, simply type something in at the very bottom of that Q&A window, and then either press enter or hit the little cartoon bubble to the right, and that will privately submit your comment or question to me. We do have time arranged for designated breaks to take questions from the audience, and at that time, I'll read the questions out loud to our presenters. Again, if you're having technical problems, you want to know where you can get the call-in information or download the slides, you can type those types of questions up at any time. There's no need to wait, and I'll be happy to work with you through the Q&A window to get that information to you. Our entire broadcast is being recorded, and you will automatically get an archive as soon as that recording is available. It usually takes about 1 to 2 weeks to post one of those. The Adobe Connect archive, for those of you who are actually watching this session today from the recorded version, is fully interactive, so you'll see everything as it happens, and you'll still be able to take advantage of some of the interactive windows, like the related URLs pod to the right. If you want to look at part one of the seminar, I'd refer you back to the archive page, where we have nearly 500 recorded CLUIN seminars available for free replay and download. So one final reminder, you're going to see the content and the materials move dynamically as our presenters go through their materials in the majority of your screen by our share window. If you're having problems reading the text, there's a full screen button that's available to each attendee. You can actually click the full screen button to blow up the slides and make them larger. If you want to turn that off, just press the full screen button again. It'll shrink them back down to the normal size. You'll see our Sponsored By logo here. Below that is a window showing related URLs. You can actually click on any one of those and press the Browse To button to open them up on your own web browser. And then again, that all-important Q&A window in the lower right corner. You can type your questions or comments here at any time. Simply hit enter or press this cartoon bubble, and that'll privately submit it to us here on the background. So with that, I think that's the end of my technical reminders for our broadcast today, and I'm going to turn things over to my colleague, Kirby Beggs, who works here with me at the Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. Kirby?
Thank you, Jean, and thanks, everybody, for coming. I see a lot of folks out in the audience who I know and who know me and who have been important to optimization, and so, you know, special welcome to all of you. This is part two of two, and just to take a quick look, in the part one agenda, we went over the optimization strategy, the evaluation process, optimization in the Superfund pipeline stages, and I'll do a little staging of this set of presentations. In part two of two here, we are doing optimization case studies, and these are designed to illustrate some of the evaluation processes in each stage of the pipeline. And in fact, we'll have a Black Butte Mine discussion with Rich Musa, Region 10 site. This one is in RI, and we helped out with some optimization there. So this should be an example of remediation, the RI stage optimization. Grant solvents, we did this a couple of years back, and we did in what we call an independent design review, which is a lot like value engineering. Went out there, offered some ideas and thoughts, and that one actually has moved along to the remedial action stage, so we can actually see the results slash accuracy of the optimization recommendations and how they assisted at this site as it has progressed through the process. Gilt Edge Mine is another mine that's part of the mining initiative, which I'll talk about in just a second. I'm going to minimize my discussion so that we get directly to the case studies as soon as possible. But Gilt Edge has been operating for a while. We looked at the treatment system there. And so that is a long-term monitoring optimization checkout at a mining site. The instructors today, myself, Kirby Diggs, I am the one of the national chief national program manager for the National Optimization Strategy for Superfund, and have been responsible for managing this process along with a number of others. Joy Jenkins is with us for Region 8 today. Sai Apaji and Rich Musa. Joy will be talking about Gilt Edge, Sai about grants, and Rich about Black Butte. And we also have with us today Steve Diamond. Steve is one of my associates who also conducts a number of optimization studies, especially at the front end of the process. And as appropriate, Steve is going to chime in with any comments that he has on Rich's presentation, which will be handling the main component of that. Looking now, this is the National Optimization Strategy and Optimization Evaluation Process that we have been going through for some time. And just a quick take look in the recap here. In part one, we reviewed that strategy, what constitutes optimization in each of the pipeline stages. These case studies, as I mentioned before, incorporate many of the findings and recommendations from both previous optimization studies in each of the pipeline stage and, of course, the specific optimization findings for each of those sites. And the optimization deliverables that we develop are, we're putting them into kind of a standard template now, and we look at certain components each time, and we'll look at those in this next slide, on slide 10. If you're going along now with me, I'm on slide 10 of the slides. Just to quickly introduce this and just summarize that optimization is not new. In fact, the number of people that are on the line with us today are some of the primary implementers of that and developers, so we're lucky to have them. We've been doing this for about 13 years. We've done over 140 reviews at these NPL sites. We were asked a couple of years back by the assistant administrator for Superfund to take a look at developing a national strategy from this work that we've been doing for many years. We did that. We finalized that strategy in September of 2012. We are currently in full implementation of that strategy, and what that does is expands optimization throughout the Superfund pipeline, looking at how we can help the regions and to integrate optimization principles, practices, methods, concepts into the day-to-day operation of Superfund, so that the optimization studies that we conduct now at such great effect are hopefully working their way out of business because we take care of those in the front end. This also integrates optimization principles and practices into the Superfund operations, which I was talking about just then. It increases the number of optimization events to 20 to 30 per year from the 5 to 7 that we have been doing in prior years. We are now conducting, we have 34 ongoing sites, so we've seriously pumped up the action there. It also anticipates a training program. We are underway working that. An expanded web presence. We're going to be hanging the web page revisions very, very soon, within the month, so that'll be available. We've developed standard procedures for ongoing technical support, and all those things are well underway. The key optimization components that we look at in each of these studies are protectiveness. Of course, that is the key component that we are interested in. Cost effectiveness. Of course, cost effectiveness is always secondary to protectiveness, but since the budget is so terrible for all of us these days, states, feds alike, localities, that cost effectiveness is one of the chief components we are looking at. Now, how can we beat these costs down? Technical improvements, that's how can you make this thing better? Are there ways that you can look at it? Are there even other technologies that you might consider to use? An exit strategy, we've tried to add that now to each of these components, each of these technical supports, to ensure that we are looking at what is the site after it gets finished being a Superfund site, and how can we make that be the most effective thing possible. It may not be possible for complete reuse, but surely components can be reused. And environmental footprint reduction, I think most all people are aware that EPA's green remediation strategy is proceeding very smartly along, and we are reducing our footprint for each of these. In the optimization studies, more often than not, these are qualitative as opposed to quantitative, but we do some quantitative footprint reduction studies. The optimization review report is pretty much standard. We try to use some of these or all of these as appropriate. Don't have to use them all, but there's an executive summary, introduction, a background, a description of the plan or existing remedies, a look at the CSM, and then there's a set of findings and recommendations. Those are the key meat of the reports, and those appear in every report, whether it be an actual full Monty report or whether it's a series of technical memoranda addressing or looking at certain components of the site on a sequential basis. We now also track the recommendations on a multi-year tracking scenario where we try to take a look at how effective these were. Were they put into place? Were they on the money? Were they not? How did the regions use them? And how did they decide? And what did they decide to put on them in the way of money? And I just wanted to mention two of these sites for today are mining sites. This is part of a larger mining sites initiative that we have put together for optimization, in which we are looking at about 10 sites to see if we can make some headway with these very, very daunting mining sites that are a very, very substantial chunk of the budget, while only being a small component of the cadre of sites that are on the list. Just a quick check into the current EPA optimization websites. If you've been on the Cluelin website, there are two optimization pages. Those are about to be merged into a single page, and that page is what's shown here. We'll be hanging that page very shortly. We've finished with everything except for the final review up through the upper structure, and I don't believe that's going to cause much change. The optimization website for EPA.gov is in the post-construction completion and that is shown with the two hyperlinks that you see on that page. Unless there are any questions, I plan to move ahead into the case studies. Are there any questions at this point?
Nope, not at this point, Kirby, that have come in, but this is just a reminder. You can type in those questions or comments at any time using the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen.
Okay, so why don't we move along, Rich, to you, and we can take a look at this wonderful study for Blackbeard Mine. And Steve, you'll be chiming in as appropriate and useful to help us with this. So, Rich, to you.
Thanks, Kirby, and thanks, Gene, and thanks for all who are plugged in online today. The Black Butte mine site, actually, to correct the previous slide, is in the state of Oregon, and this is a different optimization project. This was done looking at a site that had just gotten listed to the NPL and attempting to try to both increase performance of characterization and cost effectiveness of characterization. So just an upfront note that I want to make sure I make is I won't be able to discuss cost savings at this point because we're in the midst of doing this project and moving forward. So we'll go, talk primarily about the recommendations that came out of the optimization to try and do a more cost-effective and technically effective RI investigation here. So here's where we're heading in this discussion. The road we're taking down here is to quickly go over the site background, the process for the optimization review to give folks an idea of how that worked out, the conclusions. I'll briefly touch on some surface water work that was recommended, and then where we're headed is Region 10 for a path forward. And the key findings to date, I gave a presentation on this project at the EPA NARPM conference about 6 months ago, and we've had a number of findings of field work since that time that I could mention, and then some lessons learned as the RPM on this project. So here's where we're located. We're in the state of Oregon, which you see down in this southern inset. Portland is right here. So the site itself is located about 3 hours south of Portland down Interstate 5, and it's within the upper watershed of the upper Coast Fork Willamette River, which is a tributary to the Willamette River, which is the main drainage through the Willamette Basin of Oregon. And we're located down off of Interstate 5. There's a town, little community called Cottage Grove, but the site itself is extremely rural. It's up here in the hills, right at the Black Butte area. And the key features I want to point out here are Garut Creek is a main drainage coming down along the mine site area. We've got a small creek labeled here as Furnace Creek. You can barely make it out on this slide. It's a very small, intermittent, but important tributary to Garut Creek. And then Dennis Creek is a much more major perennial stream flowing, and the mine site's located smack dab kind of between them. And Garut Creek joins Big River to form the Coast Fork of the Willamette. This whole area is very rural. There's a community called London. It's unincorporated, just houses sprawled in farmland in this beautiful valley. When you get up into this part of the watershed, it's all private land owned by Weyerhaeuser Corporation for tree farming, tree harvesting. So the whole area around Black Butte Mine and Black Butte Mine is on private land. Cottage Grove Reservoir is a major focus of our work. It's a flood control reservoir operated as a park by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, very popular for recreation and fishing, and we'll talk quite a bit about some work that we're doing there. So the background for the site, it was a former mercury mine. It operated off and on from the late 1890s. The approximate date that it began operations is about 1897 and worked into the late 1960s when at that point mercury was no longer a good process for mining. We don't have a responsible party at this site. It's fund lead. And we've done some studies and have come up with some companies, but for the most part, major mining companies out there weren't involved with mercury mining. This was more mom-and-pop type of work over the years. A lot of research and investigations were done prior to EPA taking over at this project. A lot of it was done by the state, and a number of universities, and the U.S. Geological Survey has also been involved in this whole drainage area, looking at this mine site's impact. Our conceptual site model is that mercury contamination of sediments in both the local drainages and Cottage Grove Lake is the primary risk to humans and wildlife. Cottage Grove Lake does have a fish advisory for mercury, as do many of the Cascade Mountain reservoirs in Oregon. However, I was told by some studies that have been done that in looking at reservoirs in Oregon for mercury concentrations in fish, that this lake is, quote, screaming hot, end quote. So we're really concerned about what happened historically with mercury contamination in the lake. EPA did a removal action in 2007, looking at tailings in the Dennis Creek area. The tailings were literally dumped right off the slope into the ravine there, and much of that was peeled back and put into an on-site repository. At the time after they did that work, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality did an investigation to show that there was still major mercury inputs into the surface water draining the former site. So they asked EPA to step in. We looked at listing the site on the NPL through the surface water migration pathway, and it was added in the spring of 2010 to the Superfund list. So here's the site, the mine site features themselves. What I'd like to point out here is this is Furnace Creek. This is extremely steep up in this area. This is the flank of Black Butte. Here's an old road that winds up to some of the adits, and way up top on the backside of Black Butte was the glory hole that they actually excavated out and did mining up in there. You could see this area here. We have a feature called the old furnace capped area, and this was where the original furnace was located, up in this area. And the tailings over on this side by Furnace Creek tend to have higher mercury concentrations because they were worked earlier, and that furnace wasn't as effective at smelting the mercury out. The new furnace is located up in this area, and the main tailings from that are scattered throughout here. You can see here's Dennis Creek coming through where tailings were removed. There's still tailings. Walking up Dennis Creek just back in August, you could see tailings along here along the flank of this ravine. And then these all flow down into Garut Creek, and there's a private residence right at the bottom of the hill. He's the gatekeeper who tracks people trespassing onto this private land. So those are the main features. The disturbed area of the site is all throughout here, and you'll see in some pictures that I'll show how we could actually just look at aerial photos and see the disturbed area very easily. So the optimization review process, it began in October of 2011, because that's literally when I got here to EPA Region 10 and was assigned the site. Prior to that, between the listing in spring of 2010 and October of 2011, no one was assigned to the project, and it had been put in by our Superfund technical liaison as a potential pilot for an optimization. So we kicked that off in October and started with reviewing of existing documents and all data, pulling everything together that we could to take a look at. One of the major features of the optimization was a site visit and meetings in early January of 2012. We did a number of discussions, scoping meetings, and an entire day of site visit, and I'll show some pictures from that. During that month of January, right after that meeting, and into February, there was team input into a huge list of action items that came out of our 3 days down in the Eugene and Cottage Grove area. The draft CSM was then developed, and data evaluation logic, which I'll show an example of, for RI sampling was developed during that whole January to February timeframe also. And this was primarily done by our optimization contractor. And then the EPA team provided input into the CFM and the data evaluation logic during February of 2012. We received a draft report in March and gave comments on both a draft and a draft final in March and May of 2012, with our final optimization review report coming out in July of 2012. So things moved pretty quickly from the fall of 2011 to having the optimization review completed and a report done by July of 2012. So here's some pictures of the mine site itself to give you a feel for what we're dealing with out here. It's private land. This gate was put up at the bottom of the hill by the regional or emergency response folks in 2007. This is January of 2012, and you can already see it's an extremely highly vegetated area and rugged. And it's also, as I mentioned earlier, private property. So we've had to get access every time we've been out there and have an access agreement in place to do our remedial investigation work. Up at the mine itself, we're standing on top of some of the old tailings. What I want to show here is in the background, these trees way in the background are on a ridge above Dennis Creek. The trees right in front of us in the foreground are on our side of Dennis Creek. Between those two points, you've got a large drainage feature, and tailings were literally just dumped off the side of that. Where we're standing, you could see these weeds. It's called Scotch Broom. You can look at aerial photography and map the disturbed area of the mine site based on where the Scotch Broom is present. Where it's present was areas that could be tailings or could be, you know, mine buildings, you name it. But that was one of the things we learned through our site visit. So here's the only feature, one of the only buildings out there. It's the new furnace building, and it sits literally at top the ravine of Dennis Creek. And you're seeing, you know, once again, the Scotch Broom here in the foreground that denotes disturbed land up there. Here's a mine adit up on the side of Black Butte. There is water in there. You might be able to make out a little bit of a sheen in the background. We had a pH meter with us. There was also some water. This is some, like, rubble pile material. There was some water off where the photographer was sort of standing, and both of those had a pH just over 8. So the pH here, this is not an acid mine drainage site. The pH was basic. It was 8+. And this is Furnace Creek. Furnace Creek came out as one of our major concerns. You could see a little bit of water where I'm showing the arrow, a little bit more here. In January, early January 2012, we estimated the flow to be probably under a gallon per minute through there. What I want to point out in this figure is the heavy vegetation once again, and just the steepness, and how this is a very small drainage. It's an intermittent drainage, but we're uncertain as to how much flow goes through it during various storm events. Here's the tailings. This is just down Furnace Creek from the previous picture, and once again, these are older tailings, therefore they have higher levels of mercury, and Furnace Creek at points goes right over the tailings so that it's readily available during a high flow storm event to move tailings material directly down to Garut Creek. And here is one of the other few mine features we actually found up there. This was in January of 2012. Back in August of 2012, we hardly were able to find this thing because of the vegetated growth that had occurred over the summer months between the spring rains and then the hot, humid summer that we have here in Oregon. All right, so let's talk about the optimization review itself. Here's the conceptual site model diagram that I want to show. If you look up here to the far right at the Black Butte mine site, here's the Furnace Creek tailings area. Here's the regular mine tailings area. The biggest concern that came out of the state study that led to the listing of this site was the potential for runoff from Furnace Creek carrying tailings directly to Garut Creek and downstream. Dennis Creek was believed to also be a possible source, but less, at a less magnitude. So our focus for our RI work is to answer this question about, is there tailings material being transported and mercury being transported, therefore, into Garut Creek and down towards Cottage Grove Reservoir due to this feature being right over the tailings. We also looked at the area of the Coast Fork Willamette and Garut Creek for potential drainage and for there to still be deposition of tailings in sediment areas there. In our windshield surveys, we didn't see much, but that's something we'll have to look at in the future. That's probably going to entail someone getting to raft down there and map out the feature over time. And then for Cottage Grove Reservoir, it's managed by the Corps of Engineers, and they allow the reservoir to pretty much drain out, except for a small low pool area down here by the dam site, during the months of October through April. And then from pretty much Memorial Day to Labor Day, late May to early September is when they want full pool in the lake for recreation activities. And therefore, at times of the year, we have this upper area here of wetland that's kind of wetlands, marshy, shrubby material that is exposed. So we want to determine what's happening with the management of the water at the reservoir due to mercury present in sediments there and how that's affecting methylation rate over time. So, but what I'm going to touch on right now as an example is the surface water monitoring recommendations that are up at the Black Butte mine site itself. Here's the map that came out of the optimization report. The key feature to look at here is it does look at sampling multiple locations on each of the drainages. Here's Furnace Creek, here's Dennis Creek, and then we've got Garut Creek. So keep in mind, this shows 8 sampling locations that were recommended by the optimization team. I'll show a figure like this later on, and currently we've only had funding to implement 4 of those recommendations. This is an example of the data evaluation logic diagrams that were prepared. We have, this one is for surface water, and it's for that upper area around the mine site. We also have logic diagrams for vadose zone and groundwater work, sediment sampling, and the lake, Cottage Grove Lake work. But this just gives you an idea of the thought process, looking at trying to confirm or reevaluate the conceptual site model based primarily on this flow of mercury out of Furnace Creek during a storm event into the Garut Creek drainage. So this is an example of one of the products we received that we are using as part of our RI fieldwork planning. So our path forward, based on the work that the optimization team did, we've divided up the site into 3 OUs. So the first operable unit is the former mine site itself and all the drainages from the site above that Coast Fork Willamette River. So it's mainly Furnace Creek, Dennis Creek, and Garut Creek, as well as the mine site proper. And then OU2 will be the Coast Fork Willamette River from that point, the confluence of Garut Creek and Big River, and then to the entrance of Cottage Grove Lake. And then OU3 is Cottage Grove Lake, and I mentioned and beyond, because we don't know the extent of mercury contamination below the dam at this point. And we don't know how far we'll be able to go with that in the future. We started things off last July, right after the optimization report came out. We had a team meeting with CDM Smith, our contractor on this project, and we talked about the initial CSM as well as the recommendations, and then we focused that discussion on resource issues and limitations. Well, this is a fund lead project, and therefore it stuck with the federal budget that we're dealing with, and we don't know how much money we're going to have at any given time, so we're also trying to do some in-house work to the extent possible. and then how we can work on the fly to modify plans to meet these limitations we're dealing with. And it was a very productive meeting. And I have to commend the CDM Smith team on this project for being able to adapt and do things differently, because that's the goal of this. We're trying to do things more effectively and to save resources to the extent possible, but still get the answers to our questions to complete the risk assessments and the RIFS. And then we also, there was a recommendation from the report for a demonstration of methods analysis. This is something the region's looking at doing in-house to try and save resources. And it will, working with Steve Dimet, will put together a work plan to look at field techniques that will save us money over time to characterize this using a more of a triad approach for our OU1 MindSight work. So where are we? Okay, phase one field work, we're limited to OU1 because of money. So we did one focused stormwater sampling event. Notice it says events. This has been an extremely dry 2013 in Oregon, and we've only gotten one storm event sampling completed at this point, and it's doubtful we'll get a second one during this storm season because of the just very strange climatic conditions we're dealing with this year. We've done some limited sediment sampling as part of that storm event sampling, and we're going to initiate vadozone and groundwater studies next month. That's planning is in the process. We're coordinating work with a USGS Cottage Grove Lake study that was sponsored by the Corps of Engineers. We are now funding that. We've provided them money that they have to spend by the end of June, and sadly, once again, because of our lack of rainfall in 2013, they're scrambling because their goal was to do more storm event sampling of the Coast Fork Willamette and above and downstream of the reservoir looking for mercury transport. And so we're trying to get some work done with the USGS, but it's once again limited based on the climatic events we're dealing with. And we're hoping to begin scoping of the RI field tasks for OU1. The last bullet here is the most important part. I have no clue yet what funding this project will receive for fiscal year 13. So we're once again going to look at the optimization recommendations and the data evaluation logic to do this scoping and look at minimalistic approaches to meet our RI goals. We've also lopped on to some funding from ORD and began a project in February of 2013 to look at what controls methylization of mercury in Cottage Grove Lake sediments. That work, like I said, began in mid-February with a sampling event, and there was a second sampling event just done last week, I believe. So that's ongoing, and that's ORD funded, so it's not out of our pipeline budget for the OU1 work. This would be OU3 work at the site. We put in a proposal for a rare funding and it didn't get funded. We'll keep trying, and it's looking at doing some watershed modeling at the site. And also our technical support, our geochemist on this, Dr. Chris Eckley, is part of the Western North America Mercury Synthesis Project, which is a coordinated event, a coordinated effort to share mercury data within the Western U.S. And Chris actually, through that coordination, got us a precipitation collector that we've moved down to the mine site from the USGS on loan. So that's been a benefit. We're also looking at a pilot project that is a partners and technical assistance project. This comes from our community involvement work last summer. We've got a number of colleges, Lane Community College, and then even the London School, which is a elementary school, that are interested in using the site as an educational tool. And we had a lot of interest from students, primarily from the University of Oregon up in Eugene, which isn't very far to the north, to try and do some work at the site. So we're trying to get a pilot project with the Superfund Research Program grantees in place to help assist with using this as a teaching tool in the area, just the site work. Okay, the key findings to date, and I'm moving through this rather quickly, but this is it. Here's the map. As I said earlier, because of our funding limitations, we've only got a station on Furnace Creek and two Garouk Creek stations and one on Dennis for sampling of the storm event and sediment. And here's our precipitation monitoring station. So it's a very pared down from the recommendations approach that we've done to this point. And here's what we found. Furnace Creek's intermittent. So the whole issue of movement of mercury out of Furnace Creek becomes very difficult to quantify. We were out there in late August and it was bone dry. And we didn't see, we being CDM Smith in this case, didn't see flow in Furnace Creek until the week after Thanksgiving. And Thanksgiving week there were major storms in the northern and central part of Oregon that week. So Furnace Creek has very low flow or no flow over major parts of the year. The first storm event sampling, we saw minimal rise in Furnace Creek. And based on temperature measurements and other observations, it's believed that much of the stream flow was groundwater. So groundwater influx into Furnace Creek. There's a marshy area below Furnace Creek tailings on the Garouk floodplain. And we've got concerns there over historical features from the mine site that have come to light by the local resident. And what may end up happening is, based on our initial CSM focusing on Furnace Creek, we may have a bigger role of groundwater transport of mercury from those tailings areas down to the Garouk Creek drainage than we consider. So we also have some preliminary results on mercury, and it looks like there definitely was contaminant mercury concentrations in our drainages going into Garouk Creek. And like I said, this was based on Dr. Chris Eckley being out at our lab and running into the lab chemist during a lunch break. So it's pre-preliminary results at this point. And this is an extremely difficult and remote area for the field work to be done. The CDM Smith storm event sampling team was out there at night with headlamps and everything else in this very thickly vegetated area doing the storm event sampling. And based on preliminary results, it looks like it's going to be worth it. But some of the recommendations from the optimization review were points on maps that we can't access just because of the topography and vegetation. The lessons learned from the optimization, for me as the RPM, it was definitely very beneficial. I came to the conclusion that valuing the optimization team's input was vital. We had a great team put together on this. I sat back and let them do their work, and they did a great job. We've had continuing efforts from the optimization team to search for any resources and others that we can get involved in this project. And I can't not stress enough using the ORD Superfund technical liaison. In this case, our STL, Kira Lynch, has been vital. She's really been a mover and shaker on helping out on this project and getting some of these things we're trying to do, which are thinking outside the box, to work. For thinking outside the box, that's the term I've been throwing out because we have so little resources here. It's been good for a lot of the players on the team, but we've had a lot of concerns and questions. In particular, our risk assessors want to make sure we get the data we need to do the risk assessments. So we're keeping that in tune, but our ultimate goal is to extend what limited resources we have. And one of the keys we're seeing right now based on the preliminary field work is to adapt the CSM and the recommendations to what we're actually finding in the field, and modifying those optimization recommendations as appropriate. Because we are learning things that one day out at the site wasn't enough to teach. So that's been one of the morals to the story in the long run. So I know I went over this quickly to keep us on time, but here's some pictures to show you at the end. I mentioned Cottage Grove Lake and how it's managed. Here it is last summer with full pool. Here's a view that was taken during the low pool, and I might add that in February of last year, they found Bigfoot tracks down here in these mudflats. And so this is Sasquatch country. But this just shows you this is what happens when they lower the level. The dam is down in this area. And this whole area in here, we don't know because of the mining going back to the 1890s how much mercury there may be present in those sediments. But Oregon State University has shown that there's a pretty thick sediment profile with mercury contamination out there. So that ends my presentation.
Thanks, Rich. Really appreciate that. Yeah, I just was wondering how you were going to work the dermal exposure scenario to the Bigfoot feet into the whole process. But I think we have a question on the line.
Mm-hmm.
And that's from Andrew Cohen. And Andrew's question, which is, any plan to explore groundwater, surface water interaction more, and are there any studies that you're considering using for that?
Not yet at this time. The first thing we're going to do is actually put in some wells to look at groundwater itself. And based on those conclusions, I mean, doing any additional groundwater surface water interactions work would be scoped out as part of the OU1 RI field work. And that's all based on the results that we see in our groundwater work that we're hoping to kick off next month and funding availability, you know, and scoping for the RI. So that would be a next step type of thing.
Yeah, it seems like that interaction is going to be important when you're looking at Furnace Creek drying up and then, you know, mainly the flow from groundwater. If the groundwater is contaminated, that's a potential source. Okay, so not seeing any more questions. I actually just had one question myself, Rich, and that was, are there other mines up in that track, that same range, or is Black Butte the only one?
There was some, you know, prospecting work done to the south of Black Butte, but it's the major feature in this drainage. We do, however, I mean, this whole area is a mercury band. It's cinnabar. Cinnabar is the mineral that the mercury is present as, and it's a mercury band out there. So we're really concerned with the groundwater sampling to make sure we get some good background concentrations of mercury because we know there's mercury present in the subsurface out there.
Mm-hmm.
This is the major mine that was developed, and I mean, it goes back to, there's gold on the other side of the hill, and that's what they were originally using the mercury for the
But that doesn't feed into this feature.
No.
On the other side of the hill. Okay. All righty.
Can I chime in on one thing on the groundwater issue?
Absolutely, Steve, please, Now, Steve led the optimization study, and as I said, he works together with me at headquarters here, and he's been leading quite a few of these studies. So with that, Steve, yeah, go ahead.
There was a great question on the groundwater and certainly something that the optimization team considered. And again, it's probably a more of a funding issue as to why we probably don't have more. The challenge getting groundwater at the site, of course, up on the mine or near the tailings is the fact that, you know, it's basically tailings sitting on rock, and then we have, you know, on bedrock, and then we've got, you know, the potential issue of fractures and other things. The recommendations in terms of parsing out at the mine itself, you know, we recognize there are issues with the reservoir and Garut Creek and other things that we're going to have to deal with, and there was a lot of discussion and a lot of information that the optimization team included on those things. But at least initially, the focus is to try to figure out transport mechanisms at the site itself. So if we can cut off the source as a means to then be able to set a baseline and start to deal with the reservoir and the creeks. What we recommended was looking at groundwater down in the floodplain close to Garut Creek at the base of some of these steep hills coming off of Black Butte Mine. And the idea was, again, the initial conceptual site model and a lot of the data was telling us that we had a surficial erosion and colloidal transport of mercury-contaminated sediments down through Furnace Creek and Dennis Creek into Garut Creek and ultimately making its way down to Cottage Grove Reservoir. But certainly the optimization team considered and had concerns about what groundwater was doing. So the recommendation was, in addition to the storm events and non-storm events, to look at surface water. And we're looking at, you know, mercury, you know, both methyl mercury concentrations and inorganic mercury concentrations to try to figure out where the methylation process is happening as well. But the focus for groundwater was shallow groundwater down in the, you know, close to Garut Creek, associated with some of these storm and non-storm sampling events, to see if indeed we did have transport in through groundwater and whether or not groundwater was an issue. So that was a series of recommendations from the optimization team, and included, I think, something in the order of 6 or 8 small gauge temporary wells. But Rich will tell you the challenges with getting those wells in, getting representative groundwater, and finding locations where we can actually do that. So it is sort of in the works, and it probably comes down to funding and other issues, but groundwater was a big consideration.
That's great. And just to make, you know, I'm checking on the time just to make sure that we do not cut into our other presenters' time. There is another question from Sriram Madhubushi. Sriram asked me, you know, how are you incorporating the optimization recommendations into your decision-making processes, and how are you going to track them? And the quick answer to that before we move into size presentation is that we look to those to find lessons learned, these optimization recommendations. I think it's pretty clear how it worked into this particular site, and that we do have a tracking process that we track all the recommendations until they are discharged one way or the other, you know, used, not used, funded, not funded, and the whys and wherefores, and we're now producing an annual report that details that set of recommendations, which are then, of course, looked at as to how we can make programmatic changes that comport with the findings that we put together. Thank you very much for your question there, Sriram. I appreciate that. I hope that answered it, and let's move along now, please, to Sai Apaji. And Sai is going to present the independent design review at Grants Chlorinated Solvents. This is called an independent design review. That was before we had joined everything into being optimization, you know, investigation, design, remedial action, long-term monitoring stages. And this was performed a while back in 2000, I guess it was 2007, Sriram, 2007 is when we performed it. And anyway, let's turn it over to Sriram to talk about the independent design review. Are you there, Sriram?
Remember, you may need to take yourself off of mute, Sriram. And if you were stuck on our global mute, it's #6.
Yeah, #6.
Let's see, I don't have
any. Uh-oh, we might have lost him. Okay, well, let me work my way through this because I was here. And let me just start off. Sriram, I'm sure, will join back with us in just a few seconds. So the location, Grants, New Mexico, a small town in southern New Mexico, and a former, yes, mm-hmm. Did I hear Sai? Okay, and a former watering hole along Route 66. When you think of, you know, getting your kicks on Route 66, this is part of the route that you did it with. And it's a small town, which the highway then, you know, passed. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Kirby, this is Sai.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
Yes, we can hear you now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I was just giving them the local color on Grants,
okay.
They are, and I was finally saying that, you know, the town itself shrank, and so this is a little dry cleaner in that town. So go ahead, Sai.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for joining today for the webinar. During my presentation, I'm going to cover the following. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the Superfund site and talk about the selected remedy and discuss the IDR, or the independent design review findings and recommendations that were made at the site, and finally compare the recommendations that the IDR team made and the actual remedy implemented at the site. As Kirby has already mentioned, the site is located in Grants, the city of Grants, New Mexico. The city of Grants is about approximately 80 miles west of Albuquerque in New Mexico, off of I-40. This is I-40 you see here. The site is located primarily in a mixed commercial residential area and is defined by an area of contaminated groundwater you see in this shaded area on the figure to the right. The city of Grants is a small town with a population of approximately 15,000. There are two municipal water supply wells that are located about 1 to 2 miles west of the site. The San Andreas limestone and the Glorieta sandstone forms the regional aquifer for the site and is the primary drinking water source for the city of Grants and the surrounding communities. The initial discovery of contamination was made by the New Mexico Environment Department in 1993 during the removal of a nearby leaking underground storage tank. The contaminated groundwater is primarily a result of releases from dry cleaning operations. Dry cleaning operations have been historically performed at multiple facilities within the Grant site, although there was only one operating dry cleaning facility at this site, which is Holiday Cleaners. The chlorinated solvents detected in groundwater at the site include tetrachloroethene, or PCE, and its daughter products, trichloroethene, cis-1,2-dichloroethene, trans-1,2-dichloroethene, and vinyl chloride. EPA first began the remedial investigation feasibility study at this site back in October of 2003. The site was proposed to the National Priorities List in March of 2004, and the Record of Decision, or ROD, was signed in June of 2006. The independent design review was completed sometime in 2008. Actually, there's a typo, I apologize for that. The IDR was completed between late 2007 and early 2008. The remedial design for the site was completed in 2009, which was actually much later than the IDR review. And finally, the construction was completed at this site in September of 2012, just recently. Let's go to the ROD selected remedy at the site. The remedy for the site includes the following based on the site-specific media. The site-specific media have been divided into five categories to address chlorinated solvents at the site in indoor air, groundwater, and soil. On the next slide, I'll be showing you the various areas identified on the plume. For the indoor air, the remedy selected was a vapor mitigation system. There were approximately 15 homes that was identified as having an issue with vapor intrusion, and the remedy for those homes was vapor intrusion mitigation systems. Source areas. So there were two source areas that were identified in the ROD, a primary source area and a secondary source area. The primary source area is an active dry cleaning facility, and then the secondary source area was an abandoned former dry cleaning facility. and then the rod identified thermal remedy for both of these source areas. The shallow plume core is the core of the plume. The remedy identified was the in-situ chemical oxidation, or ISCO. For the shallow plume periphery, which is the outer extent of the plume, the remedy was enhanced reductive dechlorination, or ERD. And for the deeper groundwater plume, the remedy was, again, ERD. Now, this slide shows the extent of the plume. I'm not sure if you're able to read the text, but I'll just point out the various areas. This is the area of the source, the primary source area where the active dry cleaning facility is located. And this was identified as the secondary source area where there was an operating, was an abandoned former dry cleaning facility. And the outer extent of the plume is the shallow plume periphery. And then you have the core of the plume, which is shaded in red, which has the highest concentration of contaminants. And then, of course, we have the deeper plume within this boundary of the plume. This slide shows the conceptual site model that was generated during the remedial investigation. One thing I would like to point out at this site is during the remedy selection was based on limited data that was available from existing groundwater monitor wells that were already installed by New Mexico as part of the UST removals in the area. During the RI, the EPA did not install any new monitor wells, but used instead direct push samples to collect and characterize the groundwater data as a plume. At the end of the RI, there was a recognition that the vertical extent was not fully characterized. However, the remedy selected was envisioned to be able to scale up to treat the entire vertical extent. And the idea was that additional data was going to be collected during the remedial design phase. So the IDR team had to work with this data, and hence you will see some recommendations from the team regarding collection of additional data. Groundwater is present across the site at a depth of approximately 6 feet below ground surface. The shallow subsurface of the grant site is dominated by clays and silts with thin, laterally extensive sand and silty sand layers. One of these sand layers was identified as a preferential pathway for the migration of chlorinated ethenes from the holiday cleaners. The sand layer is approximately 6 inches to 1 foot thick and present at a depth of approximately 8 feet below the holiday cleaners area. The primary risk driver at the site is vapor intrusion into homes located above the contaminated groundwater plume. The exposure pathway is complete and has been addressed by EPA through implementation of vapor intrusion mitigation systems in impacted homes. Now let's look at some of the assumptions that were made in the record of decision. The ROD assumed there was substantial contaminant mass that was remaining in the source area, which is the primary source area, and also some in the secondary source area. And the source area treatment for the thermal remedy was expected to be about 150 feet wide by 100 feet long and 80 feet below ground surface. The application volumes, particularly for ISCO and DRD, appear to be assumed as relatively uniform over entire volume. Another big assumption was that the dry cleaning operations would continue while the remedy was going to be constructed and operated. The majority of injections were going to be made via injection points that were relatively had small radii of influence. Now let's look at some of the IDR findings. The IDR team, like I mentioned, came early in the process at this site when the remedial design was just getting started. When EPA headquarters approached the region to conduct an independent design review, I felt that this would be a very beneficial process for the site, and we agreed to have the IDR team visit the site. Provide their findings and recommendations.
Did you get lost?
I'm here.
Oh, okay.
The IDR team found that the groundwater was present beneath the site, approximately 1 foot thick sand and its silt lenses within the competent bay, and they found that the relatively long continuous lens with thickness of approximately 1 foot is present below the ground surface. And water quality data suggests that the highest concentration and most significant horizontal transport of the site-related contamination
Just a real quick request. Again, we're having some phone interference, so if you're not speaking, can you go ahead and keep your telephone line muted? Sai, if you're with me, can you just try to be sure that you're speaking directly into the telephone? Are you still there?
Yes.
All right, thanks. Please feel
are
the
you able to hear me?
You can go ahead.
Yes, we can hear you, Sai. Please go ahead. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I think that we're all able to hear you. And yes, we can keep it coming along then. Thanks.
Let's continue with the IDR findings. The IDR team felt that the substantial mass has migrated from the source area, and there was potentially lower mass in the subsurface than was likely considered when developing remedy costs. The IDR team also felt that there's additional information was needed, and also the site conceptual model needed to be updated and refined with the new data. And the IDR team also felt the estimated cost in the ROD was high. Now let's look at some of the recommendations that the IDR team made to the site team. This IDR team looked at the additional data that was collected during the design phase, and based on that, the following recommendations were made. The IDR team recommended the site team to reconsider thermal remediation for the source areas and reconsider application of the remedy to shallow core area, improve the ERD application design, and reconsider remedial goals for comparing alternatives and determining progress. Some of the other recommendations that the IDR team made include to use rotosonic drilling for better course and geologic interpretation, use the existing groundwater at the site to supplement the ERD application, and to characterize the site with additional monitor wells and conduct pumping tests. What's interesting at this site was, after the independent design review was completed, a full-scale value engineering study was also conducted, and the value engineering study comprised of the site team, the original site team that was independent of the site team, And also the IDR team was part of this study. So this study was conducted over a period of 1 week, where the team got together and looked at the remedy selected for the site and came up with a number of alternatives to refine the selected remedy. So this slide, I'll talk about the post-IDR value engineering study remedy. For the indoor air, there was, of course, no other alternative other than vapor intrusion mitigation systems. For the source area, though, the IDR team and the value engineering team came up with a solution to extend the extent of the thermal footprint from what was selected in the rod. As I indicated earlier, the IDR team had determined that the mass had actually moved down gradient from the source area. So based on this recommendation and additional data collection during the design phase, the thermal remedy was optimized where the application was only to the 40 feet below ground surface instead of the rod defined area, which was 80 feet below ground surface. And also the extent of the thermal footprint was much wider. In the next few slides, I will have pictures of the thermal footprint areas, where you'll see the difference between what was selected in the rod and what was actually implemented. For the shallow plume core, remember in the rod we had in situ chemical oxidation as a remedy. However, after the pilot study and recommendations from the IDR team and the value engineering team, the remedy selected for the shallow plume core was ERD. And for the other two areas of the plume, the shallow plume periphery and also for the deeper groundwater plume, we stayed with ERD. Now this is a conceptual site model that was developed after the design was completed. As you will see, there is not a significant change in the conceptual site model that was generated during the RI, with the exception that this conceptual site model fully characterizes the site and characterizes the horizontal and the vertical extent of contamination. So after the design was completed, the IDR team was still involved at this site and gave some additional feedback to the site team, which includes, it confirmed what the IDR team had initially found out, that the contamination of the mass was in the shallow study. This was verified during the pilot study. The IDR team also suggested using bioaugmentation during the ERD application. One of the benefits, like I mentioned, with the IDR team at the site was they were involved during the value engineering study. There were some differing points of view between the IDR team and the site team in regard to some of the remedies. However, this process was beneficial to the site team in optimizing the remedy at the site. Now let's look at some of the comparison between the IDR team input and the actual remedy implementation at the site. Additional monitoring wells were installed, like the IDR team had recommended, but not with rotosonic drilling. Additional characterization and pumping tests were conducted as suggested. Thermal remediation retained and implemented with the following changes. not used for the second source area. Like I mentioned earlier, in the rod, we had two source areas that were identified for a thermal remedy, a primary source and a secondary source. So after the IDR team's input and the VE study, the thermal remedy was selected only for the primary source area and not for the secondary source area.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Then extended the area to off-site and into First Street. So the thermal remedy was extended further down gradient based on the recommendation. So the East Core remedy was replaced with ERD in plume core. A bioaugmentation was used with ERD injection. The next two bullets, you will see the significant benefit of the IDR team's involvement at this site. During the remedy selection in the rod, the approximate cost for the remedy was $34 million. But after the IDR and the value engineering study, the cost came down to $20 million. So you see there is significant benefit in the actual remedy after the IDR and the value engineering study combined. So the next two slides shows the schematics of the...
Kirby here. I just wanted to let you know that we're running a little bit late in the presentation, and so not to want to push it too much, but we want to make sure that we give Joy enough time to present on Gilt Edge.
I'm on the last two slides. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, thank you.
So this figure shows the two source areas. This is the primary source area, and this is the secondary source area for thermal. And this slide shows the post-IDR value engineering thermal footprint, where this is the primary source area. And as you can see, the green and the red, this is the extended area, whereas in the rod, the thermal extent was only up to this point, but based on the IDR and VE recommendations, the thermal footprint extended all the way to this down gradient portion of the plume. So all in all...
And then the arrays for the ERD are down a little bit further down on that previous slide.
Yes. I don't have...
Yeah, if you look towards the bottom of that slide, that's where the ERD arrays are, a little bit further out there.
Yeah.
Nested arrays.
Yeah, so all in all, it was the whole process was beneficial to the site, and with the actual remedy implementation, was very valuable to the entire site team.
Wow, that's great. So are we seeing any questions for Cy on this excellent study? We will be posting this, by the way. It's not up on Clue-In yet, but we've gone through the process of getting it up there. And so if it's not up there this afternoon, it will be by tomorrow. So just letting you know that the other two case studies are also posted on the Clue-In website. So if you want to see the actual work that was done and the recommendations and things, you can just get them right there at the Clue-In website. Not seeing any questions there, Cy. Thank you so much for your presentation. Sorry to interrupt there at the end. I want to make sure we give Joy plenty of time to do that and then answer any questions at the end for everybody. So thank you once again for doing that. And Joy, now off to you. Joy Jenkins is in Region 8. Joy Jenkins is also one of our optimization liaisons, of which there are one or maybe sometimes there are two per region. As you heard about STLs, several of those optimization liaisons are the STLs themselves. So we feel lucky to be associated with that group. And Joy, thanks for being our Region 8 liaison. And now off to you in your real hat, which is the RPM hat.
Great. Thank you, Kirby. Thanks for the previous presentations from Rich and from Cy. And now we're jumping from mining to chlorinated solvents back to mining sites again. And my name is Joy Jenkins, and I am the Remedial Project Manager in Region 8 for the Gilt Edge mine site in South Dakota. And like the other studies, this was supported by the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. And the study was actually conducted by EPA's contractor, Tetra Tech. This particular study started in July of 2012, and the final report was issued in December of 2012. So today, for this case study, I'm going to go over the site history and a description. We'll talk about what the focus of this optimization study was. We'll talk about the facility description and limitations, as well as the recommendations and the implementation of those recommendations that we've been able to do. The Gilt Edge mine site is a mine site that's located in the Black Hills area of South Dakota. It's just a couple miles away from lead and deadwood. It was a former gold and silver mine, and it has a long history of mining in the area from about 1876. The historic mining operations at this site have left behind a network of underground tunnels and mine exploration boreholes. In 1986, the mine was converted into an open pit mining operation, and in those operations, they used the cyanide heap leach method for gold extraction. Just to give you kind of a picture here, just so you could start getting a concept of the size of the site, we're looking at the Sunday pit in front of those little row of pine trees. You can actually see a little bit of water in the bottom of this pit where I'm bringing the arrow to. And up when you go to towards the top of the side, this is the Langley benches. So that's just one of three pits at this site. The mining company that was operating the open pit heap leach mining process became insolvent and stopped operating after a mine expansion permit was denied. They left behind 360 acres of disturbed land, about greater than 150 million gallons of water in three open pits, as well as a couple little ponds around the site. Additionally, there were several acid mine drainage seeps, some which ran intermittently, some which run continuously. The mining company had also operated a sodium hydroxide-based acid mine drainage treatment facility. And they were capturing those seeps and treating water that they were impacting at the site. But when they became insolvent, they left all that behind. And in 1999, when the mining company left the site, the state immediately took over the operations of the water treatment plant and collection of that contaminated seep water. This site was listed on the NPL in 2000, and it was subsequently split into three operable units. The first operable unit is the surface mine waste, including the heap leach pad as well as the open pits. OU2 is site water, surface and groundwater. OU3 is the Ruby Mine waste dump, and this is an area that the mining company had taken all their waste rock and other mine waste materials and dumped them into what used to be the Ruby Gulch. The focus of this study is on operable unit 2, and this includes site water management and treatment. This was set up in the interim ROD in 2001, where the existing water treatment facility, that sodium hydroxide-based treatment plant, was upgraded to a high-density sludge lime treatment plant. And we have ongoing operations that include acid mine drainage, seep collection, and treatment with this HDS treatment plant. Here's an aerial view of the site. You can kind of get a general sense of what we're looking at here. Over here is that Ruby, the OU3, the Ruby Gulch repository. This was mine waste that when the site got listed on the NPL, EPA and the state covered this waste rock with an impermeable cover. We do still have some water. The idea of that was to reduce the generation of acid mine drainage from surface precipitation leaching through the, you know, many, many millions of cubic tons of material here. We do still have a source of contaminated water that daylights at the toe of the repository, so the Ruby repository. We have a collection and pumping facility here. When you go up to the, to the left of the screen, if I can move the arrow fast enough here, we're looking at the Anchor Hill pit in this area. You'll see there's a process plant surge pond here, a stormwater pond here that contains a good amount of sludge from water treatment activities in the past. This area is the old heap leach pad. Down here is the Dakota Made pit. And as you move a little further south, you get to the Sunday pit. And then the Hoodoo Gulch is another area where there is a seep that daylights, and we collect that acid mine drainage seep and convey it to the treatment plant for treatment. Our other collection facility is right in this area. It is the Sunday pond pump house collection facility, and it captures water that falls on most of the, you can kind of tell the treed area from the disturbed mining area. Water that falls on any of this disturbed mining area, a lot of the roads and flat surfaces were created with mine waste. And so all of those contribute, they all become sources of acid mine drainage as precipitation falls on the site. So that water is all collected down in this area of the Sunday, of the Strawberry Pond or of, Strawberry Pond pump house area. And you'll also notice I've got some, move the arrow again here, some pretty colored lines on this picture. And this is our network of conveyance system. We have pumping facilities at various areas of the site. We have in the past used all three pits and the stormwater pond for water storage of acid mine drainage water. And the treatment plant, which was located by the mining company during their operations, is actually up here. It was located in a location that was, you know, out of their way, but it is up gradient of a lot of the source waters. Okay, moving on to the next slide. That upper kind of to the northwest, it was in the upper left corner of the previous slide, this is the Anchor Hill pit. And this is just another idea just so you can kind of get a visualization of the site. This here is the process plant. You're seeing the heap on the water treatment plant operations and our collection and conveyance systems for this acid mine drainage water. The site operations costs have ranged from $2 million to $2.4 million in the past as well. But generally, that we have pretty high costs for the amount of water generated, and a lot of that is due to the maintenance and monitoring of our collection facilities. This photo on the right side of the screen is the clarifier in the HDS system, so you can just get a sense of what the water treatment plant is. I put in a couple more pictures of the water treatment plant here. This was during the conversion of that sodium hydroxide plant to a high-density sludge plant back in 2004. And you can see it required a building expansion. On the right side, we're seeing the base of the clarifier being constructed, seeing part of the clarifier being installed here in this lower left picture. And then finally, the completed building with the lime silo is here in the lower right. So our water treatment plant discharges treated water to Strawberry Creek, and Strawberry Creek then runs into Bear Butte Creek. Both of these creeks are subject to South Dakota surface water quality standards for cold water, marginal, and permanent fish life propagation. There is a total dissolved solids and selenium waiver for the site, and this was put forward in the interim ROD for OU2. We do see occasionally some higher selenium levels that are just a little bit higher than the standards, but our total dissolved solids we estimate to be higher than the standards on a pretty common basis, and a lot of that is due to the sulfate concentrations that make up TDS. So our facility here, the site operations, we have a 24-hour site presence, or we've historically had this 24-hour site presence, and this is largely to ensure the operation of the collection systems so that we don't have a release to the Strawberry Creek or Bear Butte Creek. This is also the water treatment plant was not fully developed to be run completely remotely without folks in the near vicinity. We have three main collection and pumping facilities, which I'd mentioned in that aerial photograph image. And we have the network of piping and pond systems for the conveyance of that water, and that was where the colored lines that you saw in that same aerial photo. Problems that we have are that we have power outages at this site. We have supplied line power from Black Hills Power, but we get some pretty wicked winter storms, and we'll get power outages because of that. Usually they're associated with wind. We have backup generators at the collection facilities, but not all of those generators are auto-start type. They typically need a person to go back to realize that they're off and then actually go and manually start them. We have limited containment at our collection and conveyance facilities as well. And only one of our pump stations really has auto controls, and that's the Ruby Toe collection facility. The picture here I've got on the right side of the screen is just an example of some of the pumps that we're using. This is the Strawberry Pump House Station. Oops, I went two slides. Hang on a sec. So our site operations crew has been really successful in treating stored pit water over the past several years. As I mentioned in one of the earlier slides, the mining company left behind over 150 million gallons of acid mine drainage water stored in the various pits at the site. We do have an average, in an average precipitation year, we generate about 97 million gallons of AMD. And our design rate for that water treatment plant was 250 gallons per minute, but the site maintenance contractors have done a really great job of actually pushing the limits of that water treatment plant, and they can run the plant between 300 and 325 GPM, so that's really helped with treating the backlog of water that was there, as well as dealing with some wet years that we had in the past. We do, however, still have about 12 million gallons of high sulfate concentration water, and this is stored in two of the pits. This water cannot be treated directly by the water treatment plant at the current treatment rate. What happens is when the high sulfate concentrations come in contact with the lime, you get a gypsum precipitate, and with the and where that precipitates is unfortunately in our multimedia filters, which is the last step before discharge to the creek, and it cakes up those filters pretty solidly. They've actually jackhammered gypsum out of the multimedia filters before. That was before my time on the site. I would have liked to have seen that. But typically we blend this high concentration sulfate water with less sulfate water, and that works relatively well, but it does take a while for us to get through this large volume of high sulfate water that way. Picture on the right is Dakota Made Pit. In the background there you can see the site. This is the mine site office that the mining company had constructed, and we are still using it today for our site maintenance contractor offices. The next slide is just a summary table of the recommendations that the optimization evaluation team came up with for us, and I'll go through what those recommendations are in the next few slides. The first recommendation fell in the category of improving effectiveness of the site operations. And this recommendation was to pre-treat that remaining high sulfate water that we have. Why this is important is we need to remove this water from the pit so that we can perform the OU1 remedial action construction. The idea for the OU1 remedial action is that we'll be consolidating mine waste, we'll be filling pits, and we'll be covering the pits, and the objective with an impermeable cover. The objective is to reduce the interaction of precipitation, rainwater, and snowmelt with the mine waste and reduce the generation of acid mine drainage that's created at the site. There were some previous recommendations earlier on in the process of that called for a larger clarifier in the water treatment plant in order to deal with this high sulfate water. So in the optimization study, the recommendations that the team put forward were for the short term to pre-treat this high sulfate water in the pits with lime addition for gypsum precipitation to occur in the pits, and then take the clarified water from the pits and treat that in the water treatment plant. Their long-term recommendations was actually to treat the acid mine drainage water with ion exchange to effectively meet future standards. It's expected that we will remove the TDS waiver in the future. TDS is mostly, sulfate is a large component of the total dissolved solids that we see at the site, and ion exchange can pretty effectively remove sulfate from the water. So how we implemented these suggestions at this point were these conversations actually just got us thinking about what we had and recommendations that we'd had before. After the study, we belatedly realized that we did have some issues with creating more sludge or gypsum precipitate in those pits, because we do need to remove the sludge from the pits. There's underground mine workings that we need to close off as much as we can. And so generating more sludge in the pits, we kind of realized after the study was done that maybe that's not a great idea. So what we did instead, I had mentioned that the site operators had been able to increase the treatment flow rate. They'd done a great job of going through the backlog of water and treating that. We've also had a couple dry years. So we have a bit less water on site than we have in the past. And this gave us an opportunity to slow down the flow of the water treatment plant and, in effect, increase the residence time in the clarifier. And what we got was we were able to get gypsum to precipitate in the clarifier without it being the same problem of it precipitating in the filters. We're able to remove that precipitate from the clarifier in the sludge removal pumps and during sludge wasting. Right now we have a snow melt on site, and so we have a lot of lower sulfate concentration water, so we're working through that at a higher flow rate, and we'll return to this slowdown test for high sulfate water after our spring melt water is treated. And we'll be considering the long-term recommendations after the OU1 remedial action. So moving on to the next slide, recommendations to improve effectiveness was the next category, or the same category as before. The second recommendation here was to upgrade the Hoodoo Gulch collection facility. And you can see on the upper right photo, it's an outdoor facility. It's just penned in by this nice fence here, but it's a relatively rustic facility. There's an underground storage tank there, a backup generator there. We've got pumps and a conveyance line coming from that. In the center, you see the top of that underground storage tank, that white circle that you see. This gets supplied power, and we just have a backup generator sitting there. This was identified by the optimization team to be the most vulnerable of our collection facilities to power outage. There's very small containment here. I think that tank is only about 3,500 gallons. The generator is not an auto start, so it needs a manual start when the power is lost to the site. And there's no backup pump in place. This area is also difficult to access. In the winter when it's snowing, it does need the snow to be cleared in order to get a typical pickup truck access in there to manage the generator or restart the system. The short-term recommendations that we implemented were to put in a larger tank for extra storage capacity, which you'll see we put in a tank, an external tank on the lower right photo. That feeds off of if our underground storage tank overflows, it'll flow right into this tank. We had enough of an elevation difference that we could easily put in this above ground tank there without it being a lot of cost and effort for us. We're also in progress on ordering an auto start generator so that when the power is lost at the site in the winter due to a storm, we don't actually have to have a person go and try and get to that area to turn the power back on. For longer term, we're considering some of the recommendations that were high-level alarms for the water level in the tank, as well as duplex pumping system for backup operation. So we haven't implemented those yet. The next category of recommendations was to reduce costs, recommendations to reduce costs. And this is probably the most significant cost at the site. The recommendation was to eliminate overnight staffing, reduce the labor force, and operate in a batch mode. This recommendation activated the discussions between the state, the EPA, and the site contractor. As a group, we'd all kind of assume that we needed to have overnight staffing. Also, in the past, we'd had water that we needed to treat 24/7, 365 days a week, and now we're in a position where we actually, because we've gone through that backlog of water and we've had a little bit of dry time, we've had the luxury of being able to think about batch treatment and think about turning the water and be able to turn the water treatment plant off if we don't need to be treating water. So that activated these discussions between the state and EPA, and we implemented a reduction in force in nighttime staffing while we don't have the water treatment plant on. We implemented a couple additional winter precautions. The Hoodoo Gulch collection facility, which I talked about in the previous slide, and also at the Sunday pump house, we put in a line power from an auto backup generator as a temporary measure for this past winter while we didn't have staffing at night, just to prevent that area from freezing up if the power were to go out overnight during a winter storm. So we are still staffing the water treatment plant when we're operating it. So we're staffing full time when we've got the water treatment plant going, because the water treatment plant doesn't have remote controls that you can be offsite and monitor that it's still operating. So we feel that it's necessary to still have staffing when we're operating the water treatment plant, just to ensure that nothing happens, because it is a hard enough site to get to that you aren't able to just get there in 10 minutes from your house. So we feel like that was necessary to prevent any releases during water treatment plant operations. But as we're going towards the future, since we've gotten rid of that backlog of water, an average water year can be treated in about 8 months of treatment. And that's going to be more or less depending on the precipitation received at the site. So it does allow us to do batch treatment and reduce some of the labor force at the site. The fourth recommendation was to reduce costs. And this was a recommendation to reduce sampling frequency. We implemented this immediately after the study came monitored with probes and field kits in the water treatment plant and surface water locations. And typically, this information is a good indicator of metals removal performance of the water treatment plant. The fifth recommendation was also to reduce costs. And this was to do not add, rebuild, replace, relocate the water treatment plant, and regularly evaluate collection system and pumping requirements. So the background to this is we've had much discussion, all the stakeholders in the site have had much discussion of when, if, where to move the water treatment plant. I'd mentioned before that the mining company put the water treatment plant at a high point of the site because it was out of their way for mining. But this does create a lot of pumping for us. And it's been a question of, you know, when do we move it? Should we move it? What's the new configuration going to be like? And it's caused a lot of discussion between EPA and the state and our site maintenance contractor. In the future, we anticipate that after the OU1 remedial action, remember that's the consolidation of mine waste, filling the pits and capping them, we anticipate this will decrease the average acid mine drainage generation from about 97 million gallons to 30 million gallons. We also anticipate that there will be a change in water quality potentially, as well as collection locations and quantities at various locations. So the site optimization evaluation team pointed out the benefits of waiting to modify the water treatment plant until after the OU1 remedial action construction is implemented. And the objective is to see the resulting water quality and quantity and the impacts that OU1 RA makes to the groundwater and surface water. And they felt that's a better use of money that we might be, if we do something now, we might have to redo it in the future. And they thought the cost is significant enough for us to just wait until OU1 RA. So on to slide 76. Our last recommendation that was made by this study was under the category of technical improvements. And this was to make some minor water treatment plant changes. The team identified the multimedia filters, which are just before discharge to Strawberry Creek, as these being the most sensitive part of the plant, the plant that's the most problematic and the one that the operators watch the most closely. Their recommendations were to add rate-controlling orifice plates to each of the four inline filters. These filters are in parallel, and what happens is as one starts to clog up, flow is no longer even, flow goes to the path of least resistance, and what happens there is it's really hard to kind of estimate what you need as your backwashing frequency. Also, this system is one that there's not a fresh supply of backwash water. You use treated water for backwash, so you essentially use water that goes through one filter, and then you push it backwards through another filter to backwash it. And so having this, when you can't control the rate of water going into the filters, it makes it difficult to plan your backwash events and make a good backwash, because you may not have a clean filter to produce the backwash water. So that's one recommendation that we're considering as we go forward. The other recommendation they had was to install backup filter pumps for redundancy. So both of these we'll be exploring as we go forward. The study was just finished in December, so we need a little more time to figure out how to implement and where to get funding, et cetera. So overall, the benefits of the study, from my point of view, is that, so I've been an RPM on this site. At the time of the study, I was the RPM for less than a year. And I think if you'd listened to part one of this seminar series, one of the presenters mentioned that plume stability often changes when the RPM changes. And, you know, that can be a good and bad thing. What I really think she was going for is that when a new RPM comes on, there's a lot of new questions. It's an opportunity to say, okay, what are we doing here? And is what we're doing the best way to do it? What lessons can I learn from other sites? How can I apply them to this site? So in that respect, doing an optimization study as a new RPM to a site has been very beneficial in me really learning the details of the site pretty quickly. The other benefits that I have on the slide here are that it opened up conversation lines for the state EPA and the site contractor on issues that had been assumed for a long time. Some of that was the overnight staffing. We hadn't talked about it before, and whether we needed it or not, or what are the options that we had with that. Also, this opened up conversation lines on issues where we'd been spinning our wheels, like the water treatment plant location and what to do and when to do it. Other benefits are having a third party come in. They bring in experience from many other sites, and they also take an opportunity to listen to the operations staff's observations, and often they can point out things that they can find the places where the operations staff is spending the most of their time. And sometimes that doesn't come to light otherwise, because the operations staff are, you know, making do. They're making the plant work. And so having an optimization team come in and ask the questions can often bring to light, well, hey, they're spending a lot of time here. Maybe there's something we can do to change that and make it more efficient. The third party also just asks questions that you didn't think about, questions maybe that you thought were answered before. And it's a great, like in my case, like I said, it's a great opportunity to really understand the details of the site by listening to these questions and responses that the optimization team goes through. And finally, there was a good financial benefit in this study. The 2013 work plan budget was approximately $350,000 less than the 2012. And that's largely from our reduction in staffing, the nighttime staffing, as well as a small reduction in the sampling cost. On to the next slide, and I just wanted to thank the folks that actually participated in the site visit, which Kathy Yeager, Peter Rich, and John Nemsick. They were all on the site visit back in July with me and my state counterpart, and then there's other folks from Tetra Tech as well as the EPA headquarters and my state counterparts that participated and reviewed the study. So the last slide I have is actually a picture of the heap leach pad. This is the spent ore on the heap leach pad, and I like this photo a lot because if you've been out in western Colorado, there's actually natural geologic formations that look pretty darn similar to this from a distance, so I like this photo. But if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to take them at this time.
Okay, Joy, that looks like we have about 10 minutes left here, so you're perfectly on time, and we've caught up a little bit. So. Any questions for Joy on this? Let's see. I'm seeing one from one of our questioners here. Let's see if I can get that. Okay, so here's one. Does the mining company contribute in paying for that treatment plant? And then a second part of that question is, can the precipitate be used?
The mining company was Brome Mining that did the that had done the open pit mining, and they became they were actually a Canadian subsidiary, and so in the United States we call it bankruptcy, and in Canada I believe that the term is insolvent. So they no longer exist. So this is primarily a fund lead site. However, there has been a settlement that went through this past spring for some of the mining companies that had done other operations and exploratory work at the site. So there is some settlement money, but it's primarily a fund lead site. And then I forgot the second question.
The second question is, can a precipitate be used? This is a question that comes up a lot. Now that the price of gold is $1,700 or $1,600, whatever it is these days, an ounce, some of those areas of spoils, which were previously thought to be not productive economically, could potentially be used. So I think that this question may point to that issue.
Yeah, and so there might be two issues there. You know, the mining company, when they left the site, they were trying to expand mining. So there's likely gold still underground. It may it would be new, fresh exposure potentially, or possibly further into the pits. There, the tailings and the heap leach pads, you know, as far as we have tested of the heap leach pad, we haven't observed that there's a significant amount of gold left in that material. We're not entirely sure. It hasn't been obvious that the spent ore and waste rock is potentially valuable. But the other question that you might be getting at there is sometimes the sludge from a wastewater or from a lime process treatment plant can be used for something else. In this case, we do have selenium in that sludge, cadmium, copper. Sometimes those metals are released when they're tried to use in other options, but it's not something that we've reviewed extensively at this point.
So economic reuse is something that could still be on the table if you would discover that, but you just haven't focused on it as yet.
Right, that's a good summary.
Everybody has questions from our earlier presenters. I'll begin my closeout process here, and then we'll be turning it over to Jean. Seeing none, let me just say thank you for the, around 28, 36, I think we had at one point, people.
It's actually about 60 people, the accurate headcount.
60, okay, all right, so that, even better. I appreciate y'all for sitting in, and I just wanted to first thank our RPMs and really especially thank them for being willing to have us in headquarters who do this technical support out to help them. Getting over the don't let headquarters help me issues. We're providing value, and we like to see that because we know that we're making a meaningful difference. And for all of those persons on the line who contribute to optimization all the time, I just want to say, I think all of us are pretty much in the forefront of where Superfund and the other hazardous waste site cleanups need to go in order to really be increasingly effective, both cost effective and protectiveness, taking advantage of all those new technologies that are being developed and then being proven out, written tech regs by the Interstate Technology Regulatory Council, by states, four states, the Corps of Engineers, their websites on optimization checklists, the Navy, their efforts in optimization, Air Force early leading the charge now, have their surveillance program, which is a lot like optimization. Now, all of us have been working together with the private sector to make all these things, these new ways and methods become used and become commonplace. And I think they're making a lot of difference. So I thank those presenters very much for their presentations. I thank all of you for coming. And Jean, I am finished with my remarks if you want to go ahead and take it back.
Certainly. Thank you so very much, Kirby. I'm going to go ahead and provide people with a few closeout reminders in terms of how you can access materials, get a copy of the recording that we have for today, provide feedback, and also just remind everybody that we are constantly striving to share additional information with the cleanup community. So I'd encourage you, if you haven't done so already, to visit us at cluein.org or either connect, follow, friend, like, whatever is appropriate for a variety of professional and social networking sites out there. You'll find that we also have a presence on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, and we certainly look forward to and encourage all of our participants to engage with us on those social and professional networking sites.
Like us on Facebook, tweet us on Twitter.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. For those of you that would like a copy of the presentation materials, we have an additional page called the Additional Resources or Links page. It's actively hyperlinked on the slide that says Resources and Feedback, but if you only have a printout in front of you, you can go back to the seminar homepage and find the Links button on the left side of the page, and you'll be able to open it up there. It's also available for those of you watching the recorded version actively right now under related URLs. There's a link that says Seminar Resources. If you click on that and browse to that page, you can download a copy of the presentation materials as well as check out a number of other resources related to our session today. The second link that you'll see on this slide is our short feedback form. I would ask if each of you could take a moment to fill that out. It's just a couple of questions, and I do read each and every one of the submissions that comes in. We rely upon feedback from our attendees to continue to offer and improve the seminar deliveries on Cluein. And in particular, we'll be interested to hear feedback from those of you that took part one in our traditional or classic interface and those of you who joined us live today using our new Adobe Connect tool. Again, if you're not actively at a computer with internet, that feedback form is available and active from this point forward, so you can certainly fill it out later on. If you're watching the recorded version, you too can still submit feedback by browsing to or clicking the feedback links available. If you shared the line with multiple parties, each individual participant can actually fill out their own feedback form. Once one person fills it out, you can click a link and let another person hop on to fill it out. For those of you looking for CEUs or PEHs, we don't necessarily issue training certificates for joining us on Cluein seminars, but many of our participants are able to earn credit for joining us. If you keep a copy of your registration email, a copy of the presentation materials, and then submit feedback, there's a box that you can check that will actually allow you to request a confirmation message. That confirmation message will verify that you provided feedback after the live delivery. So if you couple that feedback message or that confirmation message along with the registration email and presentation materials, you're very likely, our participants are likely able, are very often able to earn credit for attending our sessions through their training officers or accrediting institutions. If anybody needs any additional assistance with the seminar materials today, you can certainly reach out to myself. And again, follow-up questions, you're certainly welcome to contact any of the instructors. I, too, want to echo the group's thanks to the nearly 60 individuals who were able to join us from all over the country for today's seminar. This seminar was recorded and will be emailed or distributed via a link on email in approximately 1 to 2 weeks. If you'd like to check out part